So, but hopefully in, I guess maybe the second week in July is when our two Orthodox Jewish friends will be back to give their rebuttal to our rebuttal type of thing. So for those that were showing up hoping for that, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but that was a recent cancellation by him. So what I thought I would do here is something that I've meant to been to do for a while, which is to tie together the case for God. If you added 2 years of our talking in total, we've covered a range of subjects, but if you said, what's the core of the argument or arguments for God, and why ought we believe that a God exists? If, and here's the if we have a prior commitment to being scientific, if what we want to say is we want to take the best pronouncements of science, and then if we're realistic, we realize that the question of God and things like that are also not entirely in the empirical realm. They're also in the philosophical realm. So if we're going to do philosophy, we shouldn't just do crazy, ridiculous philosophy. It should be good, solid, logical philosophy, at least in some philosophers' opinions. So if you're going to do science, then do good empirical science. If you're going to do philosophy, then do good logical philosophy, as best derived from the most agreed upon first principles as you can possibly make. So if we have a commitment to logic and we have a commitment to science, which I think is reasonable to say that most people in the Western world will at least say they do, and maybe in the entire world, but certainly here in America, people will claim that they want to be logical and they want to be scientific. All right, if you're actually that, what do the data say? What does the evidence say? What does the logic tell you? And what I want to try to argue for you today is that not only does it tell you that God exists, it tells you very specifically who that God is. Very specifically who that God is. Now, it does depend, the top one depends on a completely unvalidated argument by the philosophical community as of today. So you can take that one with a grain of salt, but I'll at least build the case for God, as a theistic God at a minimum here. And then what I want to show is we'll derive from these arguments, and these are really the basics, what the properties are of the God that we're talking about, or whatever that thing is that results from these arguments. And then we're going to talk about costs of believing and costs of not believing. Because you can actually believe anything that you want. You can, for those that haven't heard me talk about it, or anybody else talk about it, you can be a solipsist. A solipsist is someone who says, you know what I can't say for sure is that other minds exist. These could all be either figments of my imagination or just kind of like zombies that look like they're people, but they just basically are reacting to what I say. So there are people who are, at least claim to be, solipsists. And they say, I can't go any further than that. You can believe that. In fact, you can be rational and scientifically believe that, but it comes at a cost. The cost is that which I believe about myself cannot be put on other people. And if you really take that as a limitation, your world literally stops at your skin, so to speak. So you can do that, but there's a cost to that. You can believe, you can prove that the material world could be an illusion. It's not really there. What's the cost of that? The cost of that, though, in reality, is if you believe that's the case, you ought to try to walk through walls. You shouldn't look both ways before you go into traffic. If you're a solipsist, you certainly shouldn't worry about traffic because it's all there for you. It's all figments of your imagination. You can't kill yourself with your own imagination unless you're a new powerful kind of solipsist that nobody's talked about yet. So all these things do come at costs. And we'll count the costs of being a theist, or we'll count the cost of being a non-theist, someone doesn't, an agnostic, atheist, whatever, that says, I see your arguments, but I don't agree with them. And then if you don't agree with them, what you can't do in any argument is just say, I don't agree with your argument. If you're going to be reasonable, you have to say why you don't agree with the argument. And when you say why you don't agree with the argument, you're going to end up making assertions. This premise isn't valid because. So to say something like, it's just not convincing to me, you need to say why it's not convincing to you. Now, it may be the case that you can just say, I don't know, I feel it. But then recognize that you kind of departed logic a little bit, and you're just basically going by feeling, which doesn't square with what people say is what they want to do, which is rigid logic, you know, dispassionate, disconnected, mathematical almost. And then I'll add one other thing at the end here, too. All right, so I kind of tried to build it from the bottom up, and I wrote scientific conclusions in red, and I wrote philosophical things in black. And when I say, and I do not use any science here that is not the absolute consensus of modern science. So none of this is edge or fringe or anything other than this is what the best scientists, not the best, this is what the most, in some cases, all scientists say about our universe as we see it. So we start with the easy one. This is a cosmological argument that says if, and you can formulate it a few ways, but we do it this way for here. If the universe began to exist, then the universe has a cause. Now, I left this one philosophical, but this is actually a principle of science. Why is this a principle of science? If the universe began to exist, then the universe had a cause. What principle is this in a word? Yeah, this is a causal principle. Science is only about looking for causes. This is a behavior that we see in the world. What causes the behavior? Science never turns around and says, this is a way where this is something we see in the world, and we're going to look over here in a completely unrelated place because this just happens on its own, and we're going to look over here for some other reason. Science is about cause and effect. So I would hesitate to really write this in black. I think this ought to be in red, but it is a philosophical presupposition of science. The universe began to exist, so that's premise two. That is, when I say the consensus, if you go to hawking.org.uk and you see his and you look at his lecture that he gave on the beginning of the universe, he says, literally, all, not there are the majority of it, not most of it, all the evidence that we have today is that the universe has not existed infinitely in the past, but had a beginning 13.76 billion years ago. All the evidence of physics and cosmology say that. Lawrence Krauss, who's a guy who is not exactly on Team Jesus, he's a guy who hates Christianity and is very vocal about it, agreed in a debate with Dennis's favorite guy, William Lane Craig, in Australia, that we're sorry. Where's the hat, man? Or is that only if Reuben, or if Reuben comes?
I have a big chunk of cat phlegm.
Oh, fair enough. Fair enough. You need your hat back, though. Lawrence Krauss says, no, look, agreed. All the evidence is that the universe began to exist. And then he follows it up and says, but we don't know. Well, yeah, that's right. In science, anybody that tells you, we know for a fact. Or my favorite phrase, and I don't know where this came from, but this is in the last 5 to 10 years. People say, we now know X. Whenever you hear that, just laugh. Because not saying that science doesn't build over time, it clearly does. So maybe if Newton had said, we now know that there's a force called gravity. All right, yeah, that might be, that's closer to acceptable. But at the end of the day, most people don't make that pronouncement about stuff that has been empirically verified over a long period of time. Usually it's something new that happened, and they're like, we now know this for a fact. So Lawrence Krauss says the universe began to exist. Stephen Hawking says the universe began to exist. Everybody in physics and cosmology, with the exception of Sean Carroll, who's trying to, it seems like, is trying to back a already failed model, says that this is the case. But the bottom line is the evidence. That's the important thing. The evidence is that the universe began to exist. Now, if the universe began to exist, then the universe has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. This is logic that is not contentious at all. Everybody agrees that the logic is valid. Now, what does the cause have to be? Now, science will actually tell you what three of these are. Because time, space, matter, and energy do come into existence at this point, then that cause has to be timeless, spaceless, and immaterial. A couple other things that we can figure out, and this is just descriptive, so I don't know that it's a scientific conclusion per se, but if it created the universe, which is a lot of stuff, out of apparently nothing or some previous state, now there's arguments as to why it can't be a previous state, and this is one of them, it has to be enormously powerful. So I just put that in there for note. And then why personal mind? Well, it has to be a personal mind because, and this is plausibly, that's not a deductive argument, but it has to be a personal mind for this reason. As far as we know, as far as we can think, to the greatest of our creative ability, there are only two things that are immaterial objects. Abstract objects and minds. We think we have experience with minds, namely our own, that are immaterial. Thoughts are immaterial, they're not material things. Ideas are immaterial. Laws of logic are immaterial things. So these are the two categories of things. But one thing we know about abstract objects are they don't cause things to happen. Now, unless you think that this is not the consensus, one of the four horsemen of atheism Daniel Dennett, who is a philosopher of the four. He believes the universe was caused by an abstract idea. And he says this in a public debate. He goes, maybe it was caused by the idea of an apple. Now, upon my word, I will send you that if you don't believe that he said that. But he said that in a debate, again, with Dennis's favorite fellow. Though that comes at a cost, I think you can imagine. But let me give you an example of a cost. Abstract objects like the idea of an apple can cause things. What's the cost there?
Well, then we should be seeing all sorts of things spring out into existence out of essentially nothingness.
Right, and we don't have ideas. And we don't have any excuse for not sitting in our basement and thinking as hard as we possibly can about $1 million. Right? So if abstract objects can cause things to happen, then we ought to act like we believe it. And it's the acting like you believe, and that's a theme that you'll hear several times today. You can believe anything you want. You can say you believe anything you want, but you know what you believe based on what you do. What you do.
It's the teapot theory.
Absolutely, right. And it's the wall theory. It's the wall theory. I believe that human beings can walk through walls, but you see me go through the door all the time. So I say I believe it, but I clearly don't truly believe it myself. All right. So if this is correct, and we don't have any reason, if we believe in modern science, the conclusions of modern science, and we believe in logic, then this has to be correct. This has to be correct to the best of our knowledge. All of this, of course, caveat, to the best of our knowledge. But isn't that what we do in science? We do things to the best of our knowledge. We make microwave ovens to the best of our knowledge. We use radar, which are related to the best of our knowledge. We launch rockets to the best of our knowledge, which to the best of our knowledge earlier on in rocketry was not good. But we do the things to the best of our knowledge. All right, let's go to the second one. The fine-tuning of the universe. Now, is the universe finely tuned? The reason I put that in red is nobody disagrees that the universe is finely tuned. The low entropy condition of the initial state of the universe is one of the great, quote-unquote, mysteries of physics. Now, why is it a mystery?
Because there's no reason it had to be like that.
It's extremely strange, and there's no reason that it has to be that way. And so it's for physicists who want to say the universe just kind of is, or there's a previous state that could have caused it, it's virtually inexplicable. And the reason it's virtually inexplicable is hard to explain to a lay audience, and I include myself in that. The level, the mathematics, the numbers behind how finely tuned the universe is are completely incomprehensible to the human mind. If you could imagine the size of the universe, it has been likened to taking aim at a 1 foot by 1 foot target on the other end of the observable universe and hitting it dead center. That is the kind of fine-tuning that we're talking about, the level of it. And that's, of course, really beyond anybody's ability to comprehend. Yes, sir.
Can I just interject that,
yes,
if there is a multiverse, then there could be a lot of fine-tuned universes.
So that's a good point. Let's talk about that. So the fine-tuning of the universe is due to chance, necessity, or design. All right? Why do we say those three? Again, those are the only three things it could be. It's possible that it just happened to be that way, but the reason it's a quote-unquote mystery or problem is it might be considered the most, if not one of the most, improbable ways that the universe could be. Necessity. It's that way because it had to be that way. That's possible. That is possible. Now let's think about it. Is there any reason to believe that the universe is necessarily that way? That is to say, is it possible the universe could have been a different way? Well, if it's even possible that it could have been a different way, then by definition, it's not necessarily that way.
I think that's actually correct. It's if it is possible that it could be another way, and we would be there to see it. Like, we have to be part of this equation. So you say, is it possible that the universe is finely tuned in a different way, and sentient beings happen to arise,
right,
and can observe and marvel at the finely tuned nature of their universe? If that's possible, you can say yes. But to go, well, yeah, the universe could be finely tuned in another way where there's nothing.
Right. So what I mean to say is this. This universe, the one in which we are,
right,
is this the only possible universe?
Then that's necessity.
Right. That's all I mean to say by that. Now, what you're talking about is the observer effect of the anthropic principle.
Right.
True.
That one we talk about elsewhere. I don't actually put it up here. But it's a sub-argument that you make when you debate this particular one. So let me get to that in a second, but hold that one and re-ask it if I don't address it. The fine-tuning of the universe is not due to chance or necessity. Now, why do we know this? This is a scientific pronouncement. The way that we know that it's not due to chance is, in science, we do use math, whether people like it or not. The bottom line is a lot of science, especially physics and cosmology, are math-based. Quantum mechanics is probabilistic math, statistical in nature. And it makes pronouncements based on probabilities. And then there are interpretations as to whether those probabilities represent actual things that really are, or represent our best way of talking about them because we can't really know the actual things, or it's hard to find the actual things. So if it's not, what do we mean then it's not due to chance? What we mean is it is so improbable that to conclude that is basically said, has to say something like, well, look, we are here. So if it did happen, what if there's a multiverse? What if there are a million rays? Okay, multiverse is what we do, is if you don't want to buy basically what the conclusion is going to be, you can do something called multiplying your probabilistic resources. What does that mean? That's a fancy term for saying if you drew a very, if you won the lottery, what you can say is, well, the reason I won the lottery was I bought a lot of lottery tickets. And there was an Australian firm that did this a while ago before we rewrote some laws to make sure they couldn't do it again. They came in and they figured some number, 14% or 20-something percent, that by the time they made the investments enough time, they would win the lottery and make a lot of money back. And they started doing that, exactly that. And then someone was like, wait, that's not the point of the lottery, and we certainly don't want to spend the money off to Australia, so you can't do that anymore. The multiverse is...
Much better to send it to some toothless guy in West Virginia who blows it all on the horses and women as soon as he gets it.
Anybody here been to Alice Springs?
Back in St. Paul.
Alice Springs? If you haven't been to Alice Springs, you don't know Toothless. Alice Springs is dead center in the middle of Australia, in the middle of the desert, where there's nobody with a brain cell functioning that would live there as far as I can tell.
You haven't seen my mother's family.
No, fair enough. That's a good point.
Good luck.
I don't mean to give anybody from Alice Springs a hard time. That's a tough bunch of people there. Interesting fact about previous penal colony, Australia. If you go there today, nobody's descended from prisoners. Nobody seems to be descended from prisoners. Nobody traces their line back to, yeah, my mom and dad got sent here from England for murderous England. Okay. The multiverse, now this is something important to say. Multiverse is not a scientific idea. Multiverse is a metaphysical idea. It is an idea that says, and here's why. How much evidence is there for the multiverse? Zero. Zero science.
By definition, there's no evidence for a multiverse.
By definition, there's no definition. Because even if a multiverse did exist, there is no way we would be able to detect it.
Right.
That we can possibly think of, and even conceivably. So, the interesting thing to note, though, is, and this is the cost thing, you can believe in a multiverse, but then you have to realize that when you criticize somebody over here for saying, well, you're just making up something to explain something you observe. That is exactly what a multiverse proponent is doing, is they're making up something with no empirical evidence at all to explain something that they observe. Now, the second problem for the multiverse that's actually fatal to it is the multiverse has to be finely tuned to produce this. The multiverse has to be finely tuned to produce this. Why? Two reasons. One is a probabilistic determination, and this should answer your question, hopefully. And I apologize for getting into this one, so I'll be relatively brief. You'll hear something thrown out once in a while called Boltzmann brains. This is about a philosopher, science guy that named Boltzmann, who said, when you look at the probability, and quantum mechanics says, technically, everybody heard me tell the joke about the quantum mechanics physicist that goes in the ice cream parlor? Okay, there's at least one note, so I get to tell the joke again. Proprietor of an ice cream parlor sees a scientist-looking guy walk in, sit down at the table. He always orders two ice cream sundaes. He eats one and leaves the other one there. He does this for like 2 months straight. And the guy finally asks him, hey, man, why do you keep coming? I watch you do this all the time. Why are you doing this? And he says, well, by the laws of quantum mechanics, it's possible, it's highly unlikely, but it's possible that a beautiful woman will pop into existence in the chair opposite from me, and then I will have bought her an ice cream sundae, so I'll be ahead in her graces, and maybe she'll go out with me. And the proprietor's like, hey man, beautiful ladies walk in here all the time. Why don't you just ask one of them to out and maybe she'll say yes? And he says, yeah, but what's the probability of that? So it is a probability determination that we're making. And it is actually possible by quantum mechanics that a horse pops into existence, that a basketball pops into existence, that something fluctuates into existence and out of existence in this room while we're talking. Now, why doesn't it happen? a few reasons for that possibly, but at a minimum, it's so improbable, we ought not see it in this period of time and here where we are, kind of thing. The universe is that improbable. The universe is that improbable plus some. So the Boltzmann brain idea is, it is more probable that there's a small universe, and by the way, this is also the conclusion of the people who make these models, is that a larger universe like ours is highly improbable, and much, much smaller universes are more improbable, and usually smaller universes that are consumed with black holes and stuff like that. So in one of these universes that just kind of fluctuates out of the quantum vacuum, holds for a second, and then recollapses, it is possible for a Boltzmann brain, that is to say, a self-aware consciousness, a brain that is conscious, to pop into existence and observe, and then wink back out of existence. Whilst that sounds crazy, that's actually much, 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 much more probable to happen many, 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 many times over than it is for this universe to exist. So the observer effect we answer by saying this universe is basically the last universe we ought to observe. What we should be observing is a smaller universe as a Boltzmann brain. And the fact that we don't makes the probabilistic argument, and you have to think through it for a while. At the end of the day, yes, even though there may be a bazillion, gajillion Boltzmann brains out there, what happens if we happen to be the 40 or 30 people who happen to see this universe? Yes, that is possible. It's just you have to recognize its improbability. So this isn't saying impossible. This is possible it's happened by chance. It's just so improbable that to affirm it comes at a cost. It comes at a cost. So, necessity, the laws of physics allow for a whole bunch of different possible universes. So that there are some basic constants, and the four or three fundamental laws could be different. Gravity could be stronger. Weak nuclear force could be weaker. Strong nuclear force could be weaker, that kind of stuff. So there are other possible universes. So the universe doesn't have to be this way. So based on this, probably, this is high probability that fine-tuning the universe is due to design. So this one right here is a deductive argument if modern science is correct. This conclusion is correct very, 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 very probably. Okay, remember now, nothing here is absolute for certain. But that's the bottom line is if we want to make our conclusions based on what the evidence of science are, these are the conclusions we ought to make. We ought to conclude that there's a designer to this universe. That designer could be many things, but at least there is a designer to the universe. And we know that designer is timeless, spaceless, immaterial, enormously powerful in a personal mind. Okay, well, we've got a little bit more to go on now, don't we? Now we also say, let's do our last bit of science. If God does not exist, and if you're not familiar with this form of argument, this one's called the argument of the form is called contraposition. So intuitively, if you're not in the logic, this doesn't look right, but this is agreed upon and right. This is how this works. We can explain it another time, too. If God does not exist, and this is really three arguments. I've collapsed them into one for the sake of space. If God does not exist, then intentional states do not exist. If God does not exist, free will does not exist. If God does not exist, self-identity over time does not exist. Now, but we see all three of these. We see intentional states. What's an intentional state? Intentional state is being about or of something. So you're thinking about what I'm saying now. You're thinking about this board or the words on it. You're thinking of these things. That is an intentional state. And the one thing philosophers agree upon, and people who do philosophy of science, one physical thing cannot be about another physical thing. So a cup cannot be about a phone. A plant cannot be about an animal. A table cannot be about a person. So since one physical object can't be about another one, if the brain is nothing more than a physical object, if there isn't something immaterial linked to it in some way, then it cannot be about or of anything. Now, lest you think that this is, again, some sort of theistic reasoning, I will refer you to The Atheist Guide to Reality, which was written by a professor at Duke, Rosenberg, who, in an argument with, and reference Craig a lot because Craig uses these arguments frequently, said that, yes, that's true. That's absolutely true. And so what you see, the fact that you think that you're thinking, the fact that you think you have free will and all that stuff, is an illusion. It's an illusion and it's not real. This comes at a cost. Now, it actually comes at a higher cost because what's an illusion? An intentional state. It's an illusion of or about something. So he actually undercuts his own argument, which is embarrassing given he's a professor of philosophy at Duke. But the idea is, not only does it come with a cost, its cost is irrationality. Okay. However, we see intent, free will, like, is this a scientific observation? You think to yourself, I have free will. I can choose to put this cup down, or I can choose to not pick this cup up, those kinds of things. Now, it is the case that as an observer, you're part of the experiment, so you have to take that into account. And purely empirically, it doesn't seem to be a good conclusion, because maybe you've got some sort of observer effect going on. Well, then do the experiment on somebody else. And when we do the experiment on other people, even neurobiologically, we come to the conclusion that they seem to be entirely able to choose things or not choose things, not deterministically. So when you turn around and say, what happens to the neurons prior, it is the case that you cannot say conclusively. It's coming from this reason, or that reason. It's actually empirically equal. So it could be any of them. So we unfortunately are forced back to our own intuition. But here's the problem. Aren't we forced to our own intuition on any scientific observation? In fact, if you want to worry about observer effect, quantum mechanics is your number one problem, right? Because nothing out there, depending on your interpretation, is real until you observe it and the waveform collapses and the Copenhagen interpretation or whatever the other interpretation is that happens to be your flavor of the day. But ultimately, the observer effect is never removable from science completely. So this is still a good scientific conclusion to say that we have free will. Self-identity over time. Now, because the brain changes, I mean, neural connections change, cells grow and die and all that stuff, depending on how much partying you're doing. The fact that that different brain, that brain that was this way yesterday and it's this way today, believes itself to be the same brain, that is evidence, first prima facie evidence for self-identity over time. That is to say, you think that you are the same being that has been here for some number of years.
And then also, it seems like if it is just physical, but it's, I mean, you think that it's not, then that's sort of evidence of self-deception on that.
In which case, you've got still a self-identity who's doing this even.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I mean to say by these is these are, I like these right here, because the kind of science you have to do to make this statement means you got to have like really big telescopes and satellites and lots of expensive stuff, and you got to read a lot of papers and all that. It's tough. That's still a conclusion of it, but if you want to investigate it personally, that's, you need to spend some time doing it, right? Fine-tuning, same thing. In fact, worse. Now you got to do a lot of math. Well, you got to do math here, but you got to do more math here. These things right here, you can sit in your armchair and observe. In the same way that you can observe, you can look at the premise, physical objects exist. It's a scientific statement. Do physical objects exist? It appears so. Okay, so experiment done. Let's do a run another one, see if the data compare. So far, we've got two lines on the plot. Let's do it a third time. Let's do an analysis on it. Yes, physical objects exist. Those are the kinds of things that you can do just sitting in your chair, and that's why I like this argument as well.
Yeah. I'm going to pull a Dennis real quick. So, like, the first premise, like, it seems like it's begging the question a little bit. Like, I don't know why you have to have a guy to have all of those things. Like, if you, so, like, the two left ones are true, then definitely, like, absolutely, but like, it doesn't seem like you need to have a guy to like have these things.
These things, if these things exist, then, and there are further premises that you really have to walk through, but the further premises are this. You get this premise right here by making the following argument. If there is a material, if the material world is all that there is, if the material world is all that there is, then there is no God. Because God, kind of by definition, is some sort of immaterial thing, right? In fact, what we've argued here is that he's a specific immaterial thing. If God, if the world is entirely material, then you would not see these things, right? So if the world's entirely material, there will be no intentional states, because one physical thing, can, one material thing can't be about another material thing. If the material world is all that there is, then what's going on in our brain is either deterministic in a classical sense, or it's deterministic in a quantum sense once we find out what that quantum uncertainty actually comes from. And by the way, you'll hear quantum non-determinacy raised all the time. This is not a scientific conclusion. It is quantum indeterminacy is indeterminate, means we, the observers, can't determine what it is. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
So can I ask you about the intentional state? When you talk about an intentional state, the atheist, and maybe Dennis can comment on this, would say that an intentional state such as photosynthesis, a process, can be an intentional state that is the result itself of a random, undirected process. So can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. Let's take photosynthesis as an example. I like digestion, but we can use photosynthesis. I like digestion because it happens in the human being.
Well, then use digestion. Okay. We all like to eat and have stuff work through our gastric
system. Everybody likes it, right? Exactly. It's a good thing and fun, and unless it goes wrong, then it's terrible, terrible. When we digest things, we say this undergoes a process of digestion. What do you mean process? What do you mean?
Something that has to happen for a result to come forth.
Okay, so is it a material thing interacting via the laws of physics with another material thing?
Right.
Right? So this process right here happens. Now, is your stomach about the food? No, your stomach is, and it secretes. And why does it secrete? Well, it secretes acid. Why does it secrete acid? Well, it secretes acid because it has a certain set of cells that produce acid. How do they produce acid? Well, they produce a set of chemicals that we're going to make charged a certain way, and that charge, when carried in water of a certain type, is going to make it either acid or basic based on laws of physics, based on which laws of chemistry rest, etc. So while we call it a process, it actually isn't an ontic thing. There's no process that you go out there and you can put your hands on. There's no process that exists that has to exist for digestion to occur. Digestion can occur without immateriality. And most interestingly, digestion doesn't give rise to consciousness. Digestion doesn't give rise to consciousness. So if a process, in our case the process of thinking, gives rise to consciousness, why do other processes not give rise to consciousness? And what you might say is, well, this process, only the process of digestion gives rise to food that can be processed by the body. The process of the brain gives rise to consciousness. Well, the problem in both cases is it's only us looking at it from the outside that make it a process. So that is to say, was it a process, say, a billion years ago, and things were happening a billion years ago, and there's no mind to look at it, is it a process? Or is it just laws of physics executing? So ultimately, the process description is a description. It's not a thing. So don't confuse a description with the thing that actually is. That is to say, I'm going to say that Lang's coffee cup is black. So I've described it as black. Well, black. What is blackness? Blackness in this coffee cup, in this case, is really my description of what happens optically when photons, which I don't believe in the way that they're described, but hit the surface and come and hit my eye and they hit the retina and they're turned into electrical signals of a certain type, and they're communicated in my brain and all that kind of stuff. So blackness is not a thing. It is a description, and it's a mind's description of something. Yes, sir? And then, yes, ma'am.
Sorry, go ahead. Okay. I think you're totally wrong.
Okay. That's good. So why?
Because blackness has no, it has no inherent definition. It is a shared cultural and societal term that cannot exist in and of itself. It's only by virtue that we have a language that has risen over time, that we have a shared language, that's the only reason that you can express any of this.
I agree with you 100%.
So blackness is not something, you make it sound like this is deterministic, intrinsic in you, and it's not. The way you receive, the way your optic nerves work, all of that stuff, absolutely. But the fact, when it leaves your body, out your mouth, to explain it to everyone else, that is a cultural, non-deterministic process.
I agree. So you have said the things that I want to say. It's not a real thing. Blackness is not a real thing. It's cultural, depends on language, and we was in there several times.
Right.
And that's my point. No we, no mind, no language, no agent, no blackness.
But those things arise over time out of a society.
Yes.
Yes.
Of minds.
Yes.
Yes.
Minds arise. The counter argument is that minds arise over time out of a process. Now, you don't have a process because you don't have a word for process as it's happening, just like evolution. I can't divide species into different, you know, genres, phyla, until after it's happened. I can only look back.
Right.
The lines between those things are arbitrary and imperfect.
Exactly. They're not real things.
Why do I feel like you're agreeing?
Because you're making my point.
It feels like you're shooting yourself in the foot as you say all of those things.
So the point that I'm trying to make, and this one admittedly is a relatively abstract philosophical point, is we are trying to divide the world into things which are,
right,
and things which are, and what I'm trying to do now is things which are descriptions of things which are.
Yes.
In order for things to be descriptions of things which are, there is a mind that must be describing those things. There is a describer of those descriptions. No description arises ontically from nature. No description is a real thing. A description is a product of the interaction of a mind and an ontic thing. Now the question is a mind an ontic thing itself?
Right.
So that's what we're trying to get at. And the argument is, if it's only ontic things, and a mind is necessary for the description of an ontic thing, then a description presupposes the existence of a mind, which by definition is not an ontically physical thing.
So your position is that all of these processes are all imperfect and arise over time, except when you get to the end state, which is the mind, which that is separate and unique and granted by God.
No, the processes that you're talking about are mind-dependent. So the descriptions of those processes are mind-dependent. The fact that we call it a process at all is mind dependent. So we could go on. This is a long topic we could go on. Let me just put it this way. Go to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, not a Christian publication. Okay. When you look in the SEP, right, which ironically has the exact same acronym as Douglas Adams' SEP field, somebody else's problem field, and if they realize that you can make something invisible without creating an invisibility machine, if you just put a field around it that made people think it was somebody else's problem, because nothing gets ignored faster than somebody else's problem. So the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, every philosophy for millennia have said that these things are problems. This is a part of the mind-body problem, and they call it the problem of intentional states. The reason it's a problem is that philosophers, atheistic, agnostic, and theistic, all recognize the following fact. That this is a real thing.
It's uncomfortable because when you get to that, you have to say, this is arbitrary and illusory, if not.
And that is exactly what Rosenberg says.
Right.
And now, again, you can make that point. I would just point to you the cost of making that point. That's basically what today is going to be about.
Okay.
So I don't understand why, if you have a spiritual world, there has to be a God. I don't understand why
Right, I didn't finish that. You're right. So here, let me answer her question and we'll get yours. If here, what we're saying is an immaterial thing. There has to be an immaterial world for this to happen.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's just a material world. This doesn't happen. There must be an immaterial world. Well, what do we mean by immaterial world? Well, okay, I mean something specific by immaterial world. I'm going to take further data. And this, by the way, this is how we do it in science, too, right? We take this data point, this fact, we take that fact, this observation, this hypothesis, and we build them together into theories. That's what we're doing. So what we're doing is we're establishing empirically and logically the theory of God, the hypothesis of God. And these are the facts that we're using to do so. I'm using everything in modern physics and cosmology to make this point. I'm using everything in cosmology again, and physics again, to make these points. I'm using everything in neuroscience and philosophy to make these points. And when I take the best of atheists, now let me say it this way. When I take the best observations of atheistic philosophy and the best observations of atheistic science, now there's no such thing as atheistic philosophy and science. What I mean are philosophy done by atheists and science done by atheists. These are their conclusions. These are not the conclusions of theists doing science. These are the conclusions of atheists doing science. These red things are the conclusions of atheists doing science.
They're also the conclusions of Christians doing science.
Agreed. Right. The reason I want to put it on the other side.
Yes.
Yes. And that's why I said there's no atheistic science, no theistic science. When we do those things, what we say is when I add this and this and this, now my immaterial world is this. This is the guy, this is the designer, and the timeless, faceless, immaterial, enormously powerful personal mind that stands behind, that is the cause of the universe. So this right here doesn't, just like this statement right here, or let's say this one right here, when we get up to it, you'll see that these are simplified, these are arguments that are made minimally, with the minimal amount that they can. You have to argue for the premises. So as an example, the universe began to exist. That's not a self-evident premise. You need evidence. You got to have science to make that statement, or philosophy to make that statement. You can't just say it, and everybody's like, oh, yeah, the universe began to exist. What do you mean? Why do you think that? Well, the reason why I think that is Stephen Hawking. Or the reason why I think that is actual infinites are not real. Or the reason why I think that is something else. You know what I mean? You have to make an argument for that. So in this case, the why, the stuff behind it, Mason, are these.
Your last sentence, I guess Stephen Hawking must be God because he learned him. But that's not the point I want to make.
Hawking doesn't claim to be God.
I was a joke.
Okay.
I want to make some real Dennis points with Dennis's permission. You and I have gone over this stuff for years, so I don't want to get into the details of that. But wouldn't you agree that if dualism does not exist and monism does, that Christianity is out the window?
No, and I'll show you why when I get done here.
Ooh.
So, another point.
Yeah.
If free will doesn't exist,
yes,
then Christianity is out the window.
No, same point. So let me put it this way. To answer that question, let me stand
for this argument. My third point.
Let me answer your first two and then do your third.
Some tells me I'm not going to get to the third.
Skyler, hold me to it.
That's a possibility.
The Marine infantryman that can actually probably beat me into the dirt, do it. And then probably justify legally. Let me stand in front of this right here. Let's say that we throw out monism and dualism. Let's say that we throw out self-identity over time. Let's say, you know what, this is just so hard to do because it's us looking at us and let's not do that. Okay, fine. What do we got on this side of the thing? We've got a designer of the universe whose time and space is immaterial, enormously powerful, personal mind, the author of objective morality, a maximally great being, and a trinity. Is that enough to justify a Christian God? I would say yes. So it's like saying this. I'll give you the exact parallel. Well, evolution says that we believe, our best evidence is that evolution says dinosaurs birds came from theropods. Well, as it turns out, we unearth a modern bird right next to early theropods. Okay, well, now we've got evidence that says that's not the case. Do we throw out the theory of evolution? Or let's saw open the thigh bone of a T-Rex and find blood. Now, just because we find something that we think should only last for a few thousands of years, that's in something that's tens of millions of years old, do we throw out the theory of evolution? No. Why? Because we've got all this other evidence over here. It's not like one bit of data throws it all out. And this happens in science as well. There are chemical reactions, that there's a very, very well-established theory, and then there's this one set of chemical reactions that seem to go against it. Well, people didn't say, well, this disconfirms the whole thing, let's throw it out. What they said was, I'm still going to believe that this is the way that it is. And over time, another explanation emerged of why this happened. We just didn't know at the time. It all fit together.
The T-Rex thing is, that's far from settled. But if
I'm making your point. I'm saying you don't throw evolution out just because you find blood.
You would throw evolution out if you found the fossil of a sparrow in the same layer right next to the fossil of a dinosaur. Evolution would be gone.
Nah.
No,
it wouldn't. Let me lay a personal
word. That's one of the falsifiers of evolution.
Okay. Dennis, do you believe that's the case? Would you stop believing in evolution if that were the case?
Yes.
Do you really believe that?
Be careful.
Yeah.
I'm filming this.
You found the fossil.
If you believe that, go to.
Yes, I don't get the first sentence.
Go if you believe that. I won't put you on the spot. If you believe that.
You're not putting me on the spot. I'm putting you on the spot.
Okay. Then take the pedicab someday.
If you found the fossil of a sparrow,
yes,
right next to and unquestionably from the same strata and time as a fossil of a dinosaur,
yeah,
evolution is gone.
Okay, so do me this favor then. On the basis of our friendship.
Before you get to it, let's bet on it.
Okay. I'll let you name the terms. But take the pedicab down to the Museum of Natural History.
I'm there every day.
Okay.
With a pedicab.
Ask to talk to the senior paleontologist there and ask him to show you fossils, the fossils of birds that they find in the same layers.
I didn't say birds. I said modern bird.
I'm not done. Ask him to show you what those fossils are and ask him to show you all of them. If they're willing to do so, what you're going to see are what everybody in evolution calls modern birds.
No.
Yes. We're not arguing about it here. I'm giving you where you can find the evidence of it. And what you'll find is all the great museums in the world have modern birds that have been found in Jurassic layers.
Tell me he's wrong.
I don't know. Okay.
So we'll go to another argument right here.
And this is one. We got $1,000 on it?
That's fine.
Dollars.
Yeah.
Not abstract dollars.
Not abstract
dollars. So, Scott, let me first of all, Dennis is going to be able to make his third point. I'm going to keep you accountable for that one. But, okay, but to Dennis's point, before he gets to that third point, I just want to say, I can see maybe some crazy version of Christianity that I can't conceive of that happens in free will that does not exist.
Right.
I cannot
Hyper Calvinism says exactly.
Right. Calvinism, right. There's a version of Calvinism, an extreme version of Calvinism that we could go and say that's
his head one, and it makes sense.
But I think Dennis's point on monism versus dualism, I don't see how we don't have a direct contradiction, right? I mean, the Bible makes clear there's a physical world, there's a spiritual world. Monism says there's only a physical world. I mean, that's essentially what we're getting at with monism. So I think Dennis is right. If monism, if we can affirmatively say monism is true, then Christianity falls.
Yeah. The question is, can we philosophically make the statement monism is true? I'm going to steal God's face for a second. Maybe I'll steal the cross face for a second. I'm
trying to support one of your first two points before we get to your third point, Dennis.
If this is the world,
everybody
right here,
makes Dennis points, and I can't make
them. This is doing a good job of making your point.
If this is the world right here, let's make it entirely material, with no immaterial interactions overall, and let's put God outside it. How would we know that's the case? On monism, let's say we deduce monism is true. Does that say, because monism is true, at least as far as we know in our universe? So unless we come out with a necessary argument for monism that says something like the following, monism is true necessarily, and that means any possible world, anywhere, monism is true and dualism is false. So unless you can say that monism is necessarily true, then all you can say is monism is true as far as we know. Well, as far as we know stops at the edge of the observable universe. So outside of that could be unicorns with wings, could be God, could be Flying Spaghetti Monster, all those things could be outside of what we know as the universe. God could have created a clock, a deterministic universe that he just wound up transcendently and stood back from and made it happen in a deistic model that just ticks. You can still have a designer to that who by a transcendent act that's undetectable other than some sort of design argument sets this thing in motion. There's no immaterial. We are not immaterial minds. That we are the process of digestion that somehow optically became real. That lets us say monism is true in our universe, but we don't know what's true outside the universe. So in that case, it could still be the case that something else is true. So that's why dualism doesn't automatically disqualify God. Now, what it would disqualify is the God of the Bible. Why? Because the God of the Bible says pretty clearly there are souls or there are minds or whatever. Now, by the way, I say pretty clearly, there are Christian theologians today that don't believe that. Right? The guys that believe that people are, and not disparagingly, that we're the crown of creation, but that we're animals, and that our brain and our minds are the same thing. So there are at least a couple of good Christian thinkers that think that. So it doesn't negate Christianity. But what I think it does is it would negate the most widespread and probably best justified interpretations of the Bible. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
So pretty much, no matter what evidence science comes up with, you've always got an answer.
No. If the evidence, that's absolutely false. Let's say that the evidence of science was that the universe is eternal and did not have a beginning. Okay, this argument's gone. The universe is not fine-tuned. Well, this argument's gone. These things right here don't exist. Well, this argument's gone. There's no reason to believe in God. What I'm saying is, this is what the science says.
I'm just saying that he came up with what he came up with. You said, well, monism could be true. That means it's a material world, but there's still something that could be outside of it.
But we don't have any reason to believe that.
Believe what?
To believe that there's anything outside it. Because remember, what I said was outside it could be It's possible. All I'm saying is possible. It could be God or unicorns or the idea of an apple.
So my point is, no matter what science comes up with or philosophy comes up with that disagrees with your position, you can always like create some more, for lack of a better term, mumbo jumbo to explain why God exists.
No. But listen to me again. This right here, if monism is true, there is no reason based on monism that we should conclude God exists. None.
Based on monism.
Based on monism.
Say that again.
If monism is true, then based on monism, there's no reason we should believe God exists.
But it's still possible.
It's possible because God's not impossible. It's possible anything that exists that is not impossible for it to exist.
Monism,
but that doesn't mean that you believe in it.
Okay.
Do you see the difference between proving something is impossible and proving something exists?
Second point. My second point.
Okay.
Yes, I understand. If dualism is correct and you're so positive that it does, why are most scientists, most philosophers today have rejected dualism and have accepted monism? Granted, they haven't proven it, neither, but most are monists.
I'm giving a presentation in the gap. By the way, I can't do second hour, so if y'all want to talk second hour, it'll be great because you won't have me there lecturing.
Doing a presentation in the gap.
The gap is the name of the... yes, there's a gap
that
in knowledge.
That makes total sense.
I'm going to go find a place where nobody's done any thinking. I'm just going to start typing.
I think the gap just
That's actually the better one. Yeah. The guy, if anybody's looking for very much bland stuff that is the way that the people dress me when they're authorized to dress me that way, that's where I'm going to be talking about this. So let's look at one of the guys who says this. So Dennis's question was the following. Why do the majority of blank philosophers, scientists, whatever, believe...
And I'm not saying that proves it. I'm
of
just
course
saying
not,
that...
Of course not.
Okay.
Remember this. I'm using exactly what you're using.
Well, that's not true for other reasons, but I don't want to go there.
Right. And this is where... And the cost for me, if Dennis says the universe didn't all the evidence in the universe is that the universe didn't begin to exist. And Dr. Stephen Hawking, fellow at Cambridge, fellow of the Royal Society, says that all the evidence is the universe began to exist.
I never said
my
that.
Cost for believing that is that I believe a patent attorney over the world's leading cosmologist on whether all the evidence is one way or another.
That's bullshit. I never said that all the evidence points to the fact that it didn't begin to exist. I just said that just because Hawking says it doesn't mean it's true.
Oh, that is correct. But just because Hawking says it does mean that if he pronounces on he's authoritative when he pronounces on this is the consensus of modern cosmology, yes?
He's been wrong.
He's been wrong.
He is wrong. But to say that is to say...
Can we just stick to monism and dualism?
Yes. So, here's the answer.
That's a good argument, then. It's real.
Stanley Urey is... Everybody knows Stanley Urey? Miller Urey experiment?
Yeah.
It's in your textbooks, even.
Well, you guys would love to pick one Miller Urey, isn't
it? Well, it was a ridiculous experiment. All of us who study the origin of life find that the more we look into it, the more we feel that it is too complex to have evolved anywhere. We believe, as an article of faith, that life evolved from dead matter on this planet. It is just that its complexity is so great, it's hard for us to imagine that it did. So the answer to the question is why did the consensus... Your question was, why do the consensus of modern philosophers believe that monism is true and dualism is false? The answer isn't, that's where the evidence leads.
Right.
The answer is, I don't want to conclude this.
No,
so I have to attack one of these premises.
That's not the reason.
I cannot attack this premise. By the way, no philosopher, of which I'm aware, attacks premise one. If you're going to attack these arguments, you have to attack premise two, because premise one is uncontroversial. So the reason they all believe it is because they don't want to conclude that.
That's
you asked my opinion. That's what it is.
That's your opinion.
So, why do you think that explanation is bogus that Scott just gave?
What?
Why do you think that explanation that Scott just gave is bogus? You said it's bogus. Why do you think it's bogus?
I'm not sure I understood what he said, but there is a lot of opinions of modern scientists and philosophers that monism is the game. And I never heard of monism until like a year ago. I didn't even know what the word meant. But these people are just making this shit up. Well, they have reasons for it.
They have. But just like you and I have talked about, a lot of people take a position not based off rational arguments. A lot of people take a position based off the way they were raised or psychological baggage that they may have, any number of other reasons, right?
They have given reasons. I don't have to know what they are. I just point out the fact that most now believe that, whereas 100 years ago, most believed in dualism. Bring it up as a fact.
When you ask the reason why, a question of why is a question about somebody's psychological state. Why is it, or their mental state? Why would I say that I believe something? So the only way to even begin to go after that is to ask the person themselves. I read one. There are 1,000 examples of this where guys who conclude things like monism, who conclude things like naturalism and nothing else, do so, and they say very clearly the reason they do so. I don't want for there to be a God. I don't want for this stuff to be true. And I don't want, it's an article of faith for me. And that's their explanation, not mine. Peter's had his answer probably.
The problem with monism is that it's impossible for it to be rationally affirmed.
Right. And that'll be the position on a couple of things. And that's, again, you can affirm it, but the costs are going to be... And we've been